I'm actually kind of shaken by this conference. Yeah, I like to think that I keep up with these matters fairly closely, but I've learned something new and disturbing from each speaker that we've heard. I'm feeling a little fragile at the moment, but I will talk about, been asked to talk about drones from the standpoint of the just war tradition. In light of some of the things that other speakers have said, I feel moved to say something about how I look at the just war tradition. The just war tradition has played a major role in the formation of international law. But it's not a perfect overlap, and especially some of what we heard from Gabor Rona was so illuminating this morning about the difference between the laws of war and international humanitarian law, and so on. So I look at the just war tradition primarily from a moral point of view. Yeah, I don't think there are necessarily fundamental conflicts between law and morality from a just war standpoint, but there can be, there might be. And if there are fundamental conflicts, in certain cases, between law and morality, I say, speaking for myself, and I hope as a Christian and a minister of the gospel, so much the worse for the law. And if there's a conflict, thinking of one of the questions that came to the bishop last night, as there could be, between the gospel and morality as enshrined in the just war tradition, I say, so much the worse for the just war tradition. That means for me, and perhaps I'm here, sorry, I didn't bring my notes in. Our first speaker this morning, was that Doug? What was it?
Peter.
Peter. Yeah, I'm very sympathetic to some of the things Peter said. We talked about the Salt March, Gandhi's Salt March, and so on. It means that the bottom line for me is an ethic of witness, which pushed means an ethic of voluntary suffering and maybe even martyrdom. That's what witness means in Greek, martyrs. So again, I don't see fundamental conflicts here necessarily, but there can be conflicts, and this is where I'm coming from as I think about the just war tradition. Yeah, I'm going to simplify my assignment, and I'm going to make a distinction that's commonly made between, I would have put this on the board, I teach in this room, I'm used to having free access to the board. There's a distinction between jus ad bellum and jus in bello. In other words, justifiable reasons for going to war and justifiable means of conducting a war. I take the just war tradition as giving us a set of criteria by which to test whether any particular war has legitimacy or not. Not everyone reads the just war tradition in that way. Historically, it's been used to baptize whatever war comes down the pike. That's not the way I use it. I was born toward the end of World War II. I don't believe that the United States has engaged in a just war according to just war criteria in my lifetime. So I use just war criteria to make an assessment of the legitimacy of any particular war. So I want to say something about jus ad bellum, justifiable criteria that have to be met to show the justifiability of a particular war or policy, and then the question of how that policy is carried out in practice. And I also want to just put something out there before I go into this more directly about the just war tradition from George Orwell's essay, Notes on Nationalism. At one point, Orwell says, a nationalist is someone who not only overlooks atrocities committed by his own side, he has a remarkable capacity for not even hearing about them. So I'm going to talk about atrocities committed by our own side, and I'm also going to talk about our remarkable capacity as people, as citizens, and as members of congregations, as religious people, for not even hearing about them. You know, I think we need another whole conference on that second question, as I will explain in a moment. But with regard to justifiable reasons for going to war, in the jus ad bellum part of the just war tradition, one of the criteria has to do with rightful authority. Not just anyone can engage in armed conflict. It has to be rightful authority. But the question that is bearing down on me is, when does a rightful authority cease to be rightful? When does legitimate authority lose its legitimacy? This is a question that's already very much on my mind with regard to torture. I mean, we have a government that has instituted torture as an administrative policy. This is not a one-off deal like 24 or something. I mean, this is systematic. This is built in to our policies. It's defended. What about drones? What is it about drones that raises the question of rightful authority? Well, a statement has been distributed that I wrote. You can do with it what you will. It's my suggestion for an organizing tool that might come out of this conference. And I know tomorrow morning is going to be devoted to that. You can do with this what you will. But especially as Jeremy Waldron emphasized last night and in his own way, Rush Holt, the resort to armed drones, in effect, replaces interrogation by assassination. And Rush Holt raised the question of whether this is actually not a matter of criminality. It's a question of legitimacy. It puts us in what I would think of as a legitimation crisis. When does legitimate authority lose its legitimacy? Okay, we've heard about the principles that our government is supposed to uphold and that says it does uphold. I mean, of course, there's always a gap between declared policy and operational policy. And we have to look at the operational policy and not just the declared policy. I mean, if you think that the declarations are enough, I recommend you go back and or look for the first time at another essay by Orwell, the famous essay, Politics and the English Language, where he talks about how lies obscure violence and give them euphemistic names. So I'm skeptical. I think we have every reason to be skeptical about these statements from our speechifying president about goodwill and all these high standards that we're going to uphold and so on. It just doesn't turn out that way in practice. And one of the points that was made is the secrecy that surrounds these operations. This is actually in violation of the Geneva Conventions. There's a legal requirement to identify all casualties that result from any drone use under any and all circumstances. The universal human right, which specifies that no one be arbitrarily deprived of his or her life, depends on the identity of the deceased being established as to reparations or compensation for possible wrongful killing, injury, and offenses. Our government is obligated at least to keep track of the victims, the unlawful victims. It's not doing that. Why not? Why do you think they don't want to do that? You think they don't know?
They know.
To some extent, they don't know, but they know enough. Do we have rightful authority here? Are these assassination teams centered in the Oval Office? It's a very serious question, and it leads to those kinds of, radical alternatives that Peter was talking about. Okay, so I'm suggesting that the use of drones replaces interrogation by assassination. Specific individuals, including American citizens, are placed on kill lists. They are targeted with no accountability for errors in judgment or excesses of attack. All due process is abandoned. I can't see that this satisfies the minimal requirement of rightful authority. There's a lot more to the jus ad bello side of the just war tradition, but this is enough to raise serious questions. And then we have to move on to the even, if possible, more troubling, yet people are more troubled by one side or the other. I mean, I've always been gripped from the time I was a college student about what our wars are doing to the innocents in the countries that we have attacked. I didn't know if I was against the Vietnam War or not when I was in college. I was working with Cesar Chavez one summer, actually, and we went to the Los Angeles Coliseum, and I had been reading Ramparts. I read Hubert Humphrey's defense of the bombing of Hanoi, and there were Quakers there in front of the Los Angeles Coliseum, and they were protesting the war, and one of the signs said, "Stop the bombing." And I didn't know if I was against the Vietnam War, but I knew I was against the bombing of civilians. So I picked up a sign. And little did I know that...
there go those Quakers again.
Yeah, that's right. A report has just been released by a human rights organization in the UK called Reprieve, questioning whether we have a precise U.S. drone war. The report says that there are 28 unidentified victims killed for every one target. That's about 30%. There's no way that this satisfies the criterion of proportionality. So we've got the problem of legitimate authority, we've got the problem of proportionality. Jus in bello. Jane Mayer, in the article that she wrote in the New Yorker, that's in Marjorie Cohn's wonderful book, Drones and Targeted Killing, which is out there if you want to take a look at it, maybe get it. One of the most wanted terrorists in Pakistan was someone named Bayatullah Mezhud, if I don't mangle his name, who was regarded as a leader of the Taliban in Pakistan. They found him. The image focused on him. You can see the video of this, apparently. She watched it. Authorities watched the fiery blast as he was lying down in his home in real time. After the dust cloud dissipated, all that remained of Mezhud was a detached torso. 11 others died. His wife, his father-in-law, his mother-in-law, and 7 bodyguards. That's what we learned from Jane Mayer. From this new report by Reprieve, he was directly targeted as many as 7 times. They didn't get him the first 6 times. 164 people were killed, including 11 children, according to the Reprieve report. This does not satisfy the criterion of proportionality. Even if there are cases, such as Gabor told us about, where, you know, I mean, I hate this from a moral point of view, I don't subscribe to it, but, you know, collateral damage and all that kind of talk, you can see the reasoning behind it, even if you don't agree with it, or as Gabor said, you may not like it. But this is just so out of proportion, even by those standards. I want to read something from a woman who has been involved as a targeter. Heather Linebaugh, in December of 2013, published an article in The Guardian in the UK. She's responding to some euphemistic defense of armed drones by some high-ranking foreign minister in the government of the UK. Whenever I read comments by politicians defending the use of armed drones, I wish I could ask them a few questions. I'd start with, how many women and children have you seen incinerated by a Hellfire missile? And how many men have you seen crawl across a field trying to make it to the nearest compound for help while bleeding out from severed legs? Or even more pointedly, how many soldiers have you seen die on the side of a road in Afghanistan because of our ever so accurate aerial armed drones were unable to detect an explosive improvised device, IED, that awaited their convoy? Few of these politicians who so brazenly proclaim the benefits of drones have a real clue of what actually goes on. I, on the other hand, have seen these awful sights at first hand. And she goes on to talk about friends of hers who have committed suicide after being involved in these missions. Again, we do not have statistics as to how many of these drone operators are traumatized by the very act of watching somebody thousands of miles away, focusing on them like a video game. Maybe you saw the video that was released by Bradley Manning, or Chelsea, who's languishing in prison. He was actually tortured. He was subjected to solitary confinement, kept naked, and so on. And of course, he released a lot of stuff, but he released that video. And you can see it, it's like a video game. They target these people walking across the street and blow them up, and the people in the cockpit are making jokes about it. Mm. Well, bug splat, right?
Yeah.
I find it interesting, she says, that the suicide statistics in this career field aren't reported, nor are the data of how many troops working in drone positions are heavily medicated for depression, sleep disorders, and anxiety. Look, we don't have much time left. We're looking at proliferation. The United States is not going to have a monopoly on drones for much longer. I think this is an issue like chemical and biological weapons. It's an issue like cluster bombs. It's an issue like landmines. There are areas that aren't similar, of course, but we need an international treaty to ban the use of weaponized drones. That's what I put on this little list here. I'm proposing to this conference that we support a program of abandoning all use of weaponized drones, to abandon the kill list program, regardless of the technology employed, to ban the sale of weaponized drones, to compensate the families of those who have been wrongfully killed. Here's the part that I didn't get to. I've been reading a book called The Deaths of Others, The Fate of Civilians in America's Wars. I really recommend it. The author is asked, he teaches at MIT or works at MIT in some human rights international affairs institute. Why are Americans so indifferent to the fate of the innocents in the countries where they have gone to war? He gives a historical account of this. This is a serious question for not only for the American citizenry, but for religious people. We have failed somehow. Why are people in our congregations not concerned? I mean, Agent Orange in Vietnam, for example, depleted uranium, so much, and to seek to bring about international treaties to implement these objectives. Thank you. I'm out of time.